You are listening to Screenfish Radio. I'm your host, Steve Norton. Directed by Martin Scorsese, Netflix's latest Oscar contender, The Irishman, sees the return of some of cinema's greatest legends. Starring Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, and Joe Pesci, the film follows Frank Sheeran, a young teamster who finds himself drawn into the underworld by crime boss Russell Bufalino. As he climbs the ranks as a hitman, he also works for Jimmy Hoffa, the leader of the Teamster Union and one of the most powerful men in America. This week, we welcome back Victor Stiff from ThatShelf.com to talk about the nature of cinema, what it means to leave a legacy, and the depth of silence. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Screenfish Radio. We are thrilled this week that you could join us as we talk about The Irishman, the latest drama from Martin Scorsese, famed director Martin Scorsese. And I am always glad to have back from that shelf, Victor Stiff. Welcome back, Vic.
Thanks for having me back.
I'm glad you could be here to talk about this. The Irishman is one of those unique films that is getting buzz in the theater and is only 2 weeks away from being out in Netflix at this point, and takes place in the 1950s when truck driver Frank Sheeran gets involved with Russell Bufalino and his Pennsylvania crime family. As Sheeran climbs the ranks to become a top hitman, he also goes to work for Jimmy Hoffa, a powerful teamster tied to organized crime. Directed by Martin Scorsese, the film features a reunion between Joe Pesci, Robert De Niro, and Al Pacino. And as always, this podcast is rated S for spoilers. So if you want to wait till after Netflix, you can. Or if you've seen it and you want to talk about it now, you're more than welcome to. But Vic, what did you think of The Irishman?
What a movie. Definitely one of the best movies you're going to see this year. It is everything you want from a Scorsese movie and a little bit more.
Somebody
agrees.
I will mute that. Yeah, it's interesting because you see Scorsese change in some ways as a director over the years, and this feels like one of a later film of a director that's made many, many films. It is just a beautiful piece. It is interesting. Last time we spoke, it was about Tarantino and talked about how that's changed him or how he has changed along the way as well. I think you're right with it gives you everything you want from a Scorsese movie. However, at the same time, I felt it was a little more reflective than his earlier work would be.
He's always been a thoughtful filmmaker, but this is definitely his most self-reflective film. What's interesting is he's 76 years old now. So when he released The Departed, that was a good, 12, 14 years ago.
Oh, wow. Is it that long?
I think it was around 2006, 2005. And people were like, this is the last great film we're going to get from this master filmmaker. And then 10 years later, he's released a film that the consensus right now is this is better than The Departed. It's on par with, hit the gold standard, which is Goodfellas. And this is definitely the work of a filmmaker who's reaching the end of his career and looking back on, the things he had to say and how he's been received, which is very much in line with what we saw from Tarantino, who's 20 years younger than Scorsese.
Yeah, and it's funny, and with Tarantino, the one thing he's given himself, whether it lands or not, is a self-imposed deadline.
Right.
In some ways, Scorsese feels like he's going to be Eastwood. He's just going to make movies as long as he can, but you're right. The Departed is 2006. But this is a film that feels more mature, but at the same time is very much a Scorsese film in the way he creates his characters and the world that he likes to create.
So what I will definitely say is this is his least flashy film. Goodfellas and Casino, they have a seductive quality to them. There's like a party, and even though they're doing terrible things, you just want to be a fly on the wall. You want to be in the room. They're cool people. You want to hang out in that world. This movie is really sad, and it's about coming to the end of things and looking back on the decisions you made and coming to terms with them. And I mean, Scorsese's known for his beautiful tracking shots, and perhaps his most famous shot of all time is just going into the Copa in Casino and Goodfellas, and just that shot crossing the street, going in through the kitchen, seeing all the gangsters hanging out. And almost in a self-parodying way, this film opens with a tracking shot, which is like the total opposite, which is you're just cruising through an old folks' home.
Nursing home,
watching these people sitting there waiting to die in wheelchairs and eating pablum. So he's definitely aware of, you know, the arc of his career, and he's kind of wrapping it up with a bow with this film.
Yeah, it was interesting that you say that, because one of the things I felt about this film is I was sort of waiting for the things to unravel, and I don't mean the characters. I mean, you know, kind of like, again, I don't mean to keep comparing it to our last conversation, but with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you feel like you're waiting for Tarantino to be violent, and he holds it back. This is one of those films where Scorsese's totally different than Tarantino. I don't mean to compare them. But I mean, I was waiting for more violence, more extremity in some of these, and especially because it was a mob film in so many different ways. But even the violence is just sort of boom, it's over.
Well, the violence is there. And
it's there.
It's brutal,
for sure.
And unrelenting. I think part of it is this film's 3.5 hours long.
That's
so you're waiting for it to really like kick off. And I would say the first hour of the film, I think this movie just breezes by. I didn't have a problem seeing it in the theater, but I do think the first hour of the film is its weakest. So I can see what you're saying there, and that you're just waiting for like one of those Scorsese bloodbaths to...
Yeah. And I'm not saying that it should have had one, or, oh man, that's what I wanted. It was one of those things that I felt like the violence to me felt like more intrinsic to the world as opposed to shock value. You know what I'm saying? It's sort of like, I'm going to shoot this guy. Boom, it's done. It was not that he was ever a shocking director. That's not what I'm trying to say. But I do mean that the violence there just sort of happened organically as opposed to not explicitly. It's a brutal world. Maybe I'm misspeaking here. It's a brutal world, but it's not graphic.
There's a sadness.
There's a sadness
to everything that happens. So they don't glamorize the violence in the way they might in the other films. And again, this is about like coming to the end of things and thinking of the mistakes you made along the way. And I would say, you know, killing people is a huge mistake and something you really have to sit with and come to terms with at the end of your life. So you get that sense when the violence does break out in the film. Also, what's interesting about this is every character you meet. Well, first of all, the film is told from Frank's perspective in the old folks' home. And he kind of walks you through his story all along the way. And all the characters you meet, which are mostly criminals and gangsters, it flashes a title card beneath their names.
Yeah.
And the title card tells you when they died and the brutal way they died. So, like, when we meet these people in Frank's lives, they're already ghosts.
That's true. I hadn't considered that. You're right. So it's not only that it's that this is the past. It is actually that these people are gone.
Yeah, there's an inevitability to the character arcs.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. What did you think of the now famous de-aging technology or the use of it in this particular film?
There's been a lot of talk about how it's distracting. But as someone who grew up playing lots of video games, like, maybe I just didn't notice it. Like, I've seen a lot of Lord of the Rings movies and stuff with all kinds of weird effects, and it didn't bother me. I think a lot of people, if they're not aware of it going in, it's passable enough that you wouldn't even notice it. But I didn't have a problem with it.
Well, it's funny because I know that they've compared it a lot to the Marvel films, and we'll talk about that. I'm not even talking about that aspect of it, but
oh boy,
here it is. It's already no. But I actually thought that the younger they went, the more distract. Like, I found it distracting in the scene when they have really young De Niro and he's playing. They sort of shoot him from World War II. That I sort of went, okay, that's a little off. But again, it's imperfect technology. But it's come so far.
Well, I mean, going into a movie, you always have to suspend your disbelief, right? You walk into a play, and it's just like a black background, and you have to imagine where they are and what they're doing. And in films, like, you know, there's always been, you're watching Muppets, you can see the stick holding the Muppet's hand. If a story's good enough,
true.
You know, those things kind of just dissolve into the back of your mind, and you're lost in the story. So I can see people sitting there and fixating on it, but, you know, I don't think it's... a detriment to the film.
No, I don't think it is. I don't think it is. And actually, I thought some of it was very good. After a while, I found myself transfixed by the story so much that it was sort of one of those things that I just lost. But because people are talking about it, like, I mean, this is what they're all doing now. I even heard that they're trying to bring back
James Dean.
And, you know, of course, there's a huge backlash. And the directors were... say they were shocked. Like, why were people upset? We just thought it would be a lot of fun or it would be cool. Well, okay, there are limits to this. There should be some limits in some ways. But so everybody's sort of trying to do it. And it used to be they would just use facial makeup and they would dye the hair and they would shoot from this angle, use stuff like that. But now they're actually trying to make you believe that they're younger than they are digitally.
It's a slippery slope because it's going to reach a point where they're going to have high resolutions of everybody's faces and they'll be able to stitch them onto any movie. I actually think it's going to reach the point where you or I can walk into a booth, get a high definition facial scan and like a Snapchat filter, watch a movie and say, I want to be in that movie and slap your face on it.
Yeah.
20 years, I guarantee you that's going to be a thing.
Yeah, I think it'll be even sooner than that because to be honest, I mean, that just feels like a Snapchat filter. You know, it feels like...
Which would have been impossible 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Now we just have it on our phones.
It almost depends on who it was, but I know when Rogue One came out, they did that with...
Moff Tarkin?
Grand Moff Tarkin, but I forget what the actor's name was, but he'd been dead for 25 years. And I'm not even talking about the quality of the animation, because clearly they're still trying to work it all out, but nobody outcried. Everyone thought, oh, that's cool. But sort of there's these questions that sort of come with it. I'm like, well, wait a second.
James Dean was the ultimate rebel. Like, is he the person who's going to want his face just, you know, sold out to some corporation that he wouldn't have agreed with?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, all that to say, I thought that it worked very, very well on The Irishman. And I thought the work on De Niro was especially good. See, this is the thing. As you talk about getting engrossed in the story, sometimes it's distracting, not because... oh, you don't look quite young enough, but if it's not quite in sync, then to me it's distracting in those moments. Like, there were scenes in the last, Gemini Man. I saw Gemini Man.
Right.
And there were some scenes where it looked, now again, the whole high frame rate, blah, 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 but there are some scenes where you look at it and it took me out of the film.
Right.
There aren't many scenes in The Irishman that does that with me.
Yeah, I've played like too many bad PlayStation games with terrible facial animation. Like,
it's even notice.
Yeah, it doesn't even track anymore. Like, maybe 20 years ago it would have bothered me, but now it's the least of my problems.
That's fair. And I will say, I think it's one of the best scripts that I've seen this year. It's a pretty remarkable film that sort of unspools in this. I don't want to use the term slow because that brings a sort of a connotation to it. People think that that's boring.
It's measured.
Measured is a better way to describe it. Thank you for that, because it takes its time, it goes its pace, and it never deviates from it. It tells its story, lets it unravel it in its own way. And actually, that's one of the things I felt about it, is whether or not this is Scorsese's last great film, which would be a terrible limitation to put on him to say he couldn't do it again. I'm sure he could. But this, to me, felt like Scorsese saying, you know what, I'm going to tell my story my way. And this is how I'm going to do it.
Well, even at 3.5 hours long, I really do think this film benefits from a second watch. Because again, it's all about the ending of things, the ending of a career. So you can read that as Frank Sheeran looking back at his life and coming to terms with what he's done. But you can also look at it as Martin Scorsese looking back at his career and wrapping everything up. So it all doesn't really come into focus until the final half hour of the film. And again, that's really why you have to I encourage you to see it in a theater, because when you're sitting there at home, you're going to be tempted to pause it, go to the fridge, you know, maybe it's too long, you restart it the next day. This film really wallops you with the last 30 minutes, and it's going to wallop you the hardest in the way it's intended if you see it in 1 3.5 hour chunk. But again, I would recommend watching it a second time, because once you know what's coming and how it wraps up, it gives more depth and nuance to the story.
You see, it's interesting to me that he is doing this as a Netflix film, because there is an entirely different way he could have done this. He could have done it as a four episode miniseries that all released at the same time, because that's how people binge. That's how people consume media now, right, on Netflix. And yet he didn't want to do that. So this is he wanted it to be this sort of film. So it is very interesting to me that you said that, because how is this going to be consumed? I can't see many people sitting at home and binging this in 3.5 hours. I can see many people putting it on for 45 minutes and wondering either A, what are they watching? Or B, are they going to commit the rest of the time to it? But it is a story that goes from beginning to end. It unravels at its own pace. You're absolutely right that the story, I actually felt like it was going to go a completely different direction in some ways until Pacino shows up.
Right.
Because the Buffalino storyline, I just assumed it was going to be this young mobster who rises up through the ranks, and then, which is what happened. but it could have very easily become one of these things where he's challenging for, you know, trying to take on Bufalino for his leadership, and then gets involved. You know, like the way it unravels at the beginning is him just coming up through the ranks.
Right, and it's very much about his relationship to Hoffa. And those two, just the chemistry they have, and it, for such a story about these like cold-blooded, ruthless people, there is a bit of warmth to the way they regard each other.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I noticed in the film particularly is that you've got two actors that are sort of known for losing it.
Right.
And they never really do.
Three, even.
Three, yeah, you're right. Yeah, Pesci, too. And they're, again, going back to measured, you've got measured performances. Pacino, especially, is one of those guys that, you know, just wants to let go, but he doesn't very often.
At this point in his career, Pacino seems to do a caricature of Al Pacino.
I guess that's true.
This movie, he's definitely the loudest, most colorful character, but by Pacino and Nick Cage standards, it's probably like a 4 out of 10, which is like a 9 out of 10 on most people's scales.
Oh, man, is there a Nick Cage scale that we
have? I think he has his own scale, yeah.
You know, we keep talking about the film and its pacing and being measured. I would like to talk about the nature of cinema, which seems like a jump, but it isn't, because so much has been made in recent weeks about Scorsese and his views on cinema versus Marvel. He called Marvel films theme park rides.
Right. They're not true cinema.
They're not true cinema, so much so that he's had to double down on this three times. I was wondering what you think about that statement, or even just his ideology, that from what you've read.
There's a couple ways you can look at this. So the one that people are really incensed about is that they think he's crapping all over the thing they love. And if you really listen to what he's saying and read his op-ed, it's not so much that he's trashing Marvel so much as standing up for the cinema that's kind of taking a backseat because it's in Marvel's shadow, right? So if something like Avengers is storming through the theaters, there's less room for things like Roma and The Irishman and Marriage Story. So you can't really argue with them there. You know, I grew up reading comic books in the 80s and 90s, and there's an insecurity that came with that. Like, you didn't tell people you're into comics, and it's unthinkable now, but people didn't know who Steve Rogers and Tony Stark were until, like, 2008. So comic fans, we've always had this chip on our shoulder about not being taken seriously, about not being cool. And I think that's still there, so that when someone, especially someone as respected as Scorsese, comes out and kind of poo-poos all over the thing we love, like, we really feel like we have to stand up and beat our chest and say it's not true. I think if we were a little bit more secure about the thing we love, we wouldn't need to defend it so hard.
The funny thing to me is that the fact that he calls it theme park rides, the suggestion is that somehow those have no value. I have no issue with so many with these sort of things be called rides because of the nature of how they're filmed. And I don't think that's a slight. I think it could be considered a slight if people want to read it that way. But, I mean, I had mentioned to you before, one of the things Paul Schrader said once before was that modern cinema is all about trying to get the audience's adoration. So there's, look at me here, love me was this quote. And I can see that when you hold it up to a film like The Irishman, because The Irishman has no such sensibilities. There's no flash.
Right.
Like, you know, there's no whiz-bang or car chases or anything like that. But that's not to take away from those things. I think there's a symbiotic relationship.
I think cinema encompasses all those things, and we shouldn't really be comparing which has more value, right?
Right.
Because it's all relative. Like, there's kids in hospitals who are, like, getting through being in agony every day because they can watch Avengers or because Black Panther's their hero. Yeah. So, like, does that make the movie more important or less important than The Irishman, right? There's someone who might be inspired to get into film studies because The Irishman touched them, and it was like the most deep and thoughtful film they'd ever seen. So there's a place for both things. I don't see why we want to just have a narrow band of what is true cinema and what is trash cinema. Look at someone like Quentin Tarantino. His entire filmography came from worshiping what people consider trash cinema, yeah. Right? Martial arts movies and westerns. You know, those films at the time they came out, people, you know, they're for, like, kids and hippies. No one wants to go see that. Now they're putting those films in the Library of Congress. Where will these Marvel movies be in, like, 30 years when, like, the next wave of Scorsese's and Tarantino's say, I got into film because I love these movies? All of a sudden there's going to be a different sheen on them, and they're going to have a different merit and a different value.
But you see, too, this also exposes a wound that's already there from the Oscars. You know, because as the Oscars get to be seen as increasingly irrelevant.
Right.
I think it was 2008 or whenever it was The Dark Knight came out. Yes. And that was the one that everybody said, this should be nominated. This is a great film, as opposed to just a, quote, comic book movie, because at the time they were still saying just a comic book movie. I think they still are in some circles.
Oh, for sure.
But, I mean, at the time, this was the first one that was really pushed for this is it. And Black Panther, of course, was the first one to actually get nominated. But that really exposed a wound. And as the Oscars proclaim this is what the best picture of the year is, which Irishman is going to be up for, I have no doubt. And yet, at the same time, you know, people who are not going to spend the money say, oh, it's 3.5 hours. I don't want to spend my money to see that. Now that it's on Netflix, maybe they will. The Oscars, as they become increasingly irrelevant, this feels like doubling down.
Yeah, again, like, this is not a profound statement, but I mean, you know, all value is relative, and the value something receives by being in the Oscar race, it matters at the time, but like 20 years from now, is anyone going to look back at Green Book and say, like, that's the best movie that came out in 2018?
I always go back to the year that King's Speech won Best Picture, and at that time, it was up, its fiercest competition was The Social Network. And I remember so clearly there was that Social Network, I think it won like the PGAs or something, and King's Speech won like the DGAs. Like there was some very clear lines being drawn, and it became a generational thing. If you were under 30 or under 40, you wanted The Social Network to win. If you were over 40, King's Speech is the best movie of the year. And I remember they brought out Spielberg to hand out the award, and I will never forget his speech. He said, in a moment, I'm going to read a name. And it is going to be of the like, and it will go in the books with films like Gone with the Wind and The Godfather, and he lists off these Best Picture winners. And there will be other films that I'm going to read, and they will go into the same level as films like Citizen Kane and Raging Bull. And he right. listed off these other great films that never won. And after that, you could almost hear, like, the air in the room, everyone went, oh, okay. Doesn't matter who wins now, because you're right. There's still great films. A great film is going to last.
Well, we're in 2019, and everybody and their mom is coming up with a best of the decade list. Mm. And The Social Network is not only on a huge swath of best of the decade list, it's at or near the top. Mm. The King's Speech isn't on any of them.
Really? No, I'm kidding. Next thing you're going to tell me is that Pulp Fiction deserved to beat Forrest Gump. I mean, I can't know.
Forrest Gump had set the precedent to bring James Dean back.
It's Forrest Gump's fault. That's it.
Yeah, that's what it'll be known for.
That's true. I'd never considered that. You're absolutely right. To me, I think you're right. I think it really just taps into a conversation that suggests that somehow one is lesser than the other. But Hollywood needed those Saturday afternoon serials. Like, those are the ones that brought us Indiana Jones.
Right.
Those are the ones Spielberg grew up on and brought us these great films. And nobody thinks that Jaws is just pulp. People think one of Jaws is one of the great films of the last century.
But did they think that in 1977 is the question?
I don't think they had the argument back then. I mean, they may have. I think it really started with Star Wars, and I'm a huge Star Wars fan, but I would have argued that Star Wars might have been the first that really did, but I don't know. Like, now with the way we have the internet and everybody's got a podcast and Twitter account and everybody's got their voice, but keep listening to this one. I mean, I think there's so many voices out there that trying to say what is best and what is trash.
Well, as a film critic who covers hundreds of films and has to trash a lot of films, I always keep in mind every movie is somebody's favorite movie, no matter how bad it is or how meritless you think it is. At the very least, someone put their heart and soul into it. So, you know, it's easy to kind of fall into a camp of, like, this is what I love, and that makes it more important than what you love. But, you know, we have to be more understanding that whatever works for someone, whatever gets them through these crazy times, like, we shouldn't trash it. We should just celebrate it.
Yeah, you and I met at the screening of Anna and the Apocalypse, by the way. That's
That was a fun one.
It was. And lest we forget that, just for the sake of argument, for 4 years, Martin Scorsese was in charge of the Joker movie. So he had dipped his toe in the water.
There was talk of casting his muse, Leonardo DiCaprio, in there.
Really? Oh, I hadn't. Well, that just makes sense. Who are we kidding? I'm surprised DiCaprio didn't show up in The Irishman,
right?
As a shoeshine boy or something like that. I
don't too pretty for that movie.
Let's talk about the film again itself. You know, let's talk about the characters. Specifically, why don't we look at the world that he's created? I mean, mob movies have a set of rules. Do you think that this place operated under a specific set of rules, or was it more flexible for these guys as they went along? What was it you think was their high value?
Excellent question. It didn't feel like the average crime film where someone gets pulled into a world and then we're introduced to that world. He just kind of, Frank gently slipped into, well, he kind of hit the ground running. It's like he was built for this world even before it found him. I don't know. I have to think about that for a minute.
Yeah, I honestly, I'm not entirely sure myself either.
Well, we know that the gangster code is always, you know, we look out for each other. We don't let outsiders in. You know, we don't rat on each other. Mm. We don't lie to each other. And if you're down, we're going to pick you up. So that's kind of intrinsic to these movies. And as we get closer to the end of the movie, they start breaking these codes and inevitably turning on each other. I don't know if that's necessarily laid out for us, but it's just something you kind of a shorthand you pick up with the genre.
Yeah, see, and the other one that's a shorthand I've always felt with the genre is family. But family in this one, I feel like, even looks differently. It feels like there's multiple families warring for Frank, if you will, and to the neglect of his own. You know, the most time we see it with his family is his daughter informs her that the guy at the grocery store, the corner store, you know, pushed her. She was stealing something, and he pushed her down, and he goes out and he beats the tar out of this guy.
Right.
But that ends up doing damage to her. I think after, like, they indicate later on that they were scared of what he would do. But normally in a mob film, this is one of the things I thought was so unique to The Irishman. Normally there's one family that you almost have to declare your allegiance to. He has multiple ones.
Yeah, he's kind of like a free agent. He's like LeBron James jumping to the Lakers.
Yeah, but if he was also playing for the Clippers at the same time.
Right.
It's interesting. I don't like this is where the pastor in me kicks in and out, but it opens and closes with a communion scene. I don't know if you noticed that or not, but he's got the wine and the bread and he breaks it with Buffalino in the nursing home at the beginning when they're first seeing. They sort of talk about the vine, which is sort of a communion image, which suggests a bond, which there is that bond. But he's also got this loyalty as well to Hoffa, to Pacino's character, where he sort of gets bounced around. I thought this is such a fascinating role for Frank. He's almost a pinball in between so many of these different worlds.
Well, this is a very existential film, and it ends on a bleak note. And it's really about reflecting on the choices we made throughout our lives and how, in the end, like, it really doesn't matter. You end up in the same place. And the lies you tell yourself to get through from day to day and take care of your family and get the things you want. It's like, did you spend your time correctly? And this is a man who did not spend his life correctly. Mm. He dedicated it to a life of crime, and he was a murderer, and, you know, he beat people up and he stole money to give his family a better life, but he was never there for his family, right? And at the end, he has to come to terms with that. So it's really just a film that highlights a series of poor decisions and then shows you what the results are.
Yeah, and again, you know, those poor decisions to him are very clearly right decisions.
At the time.
Not at the end as he's telling the story. Although, and sidebar, I understand he's speaking to the priest, but is he telling his story to the priest? Because I don't think we ever see the face of him actually, of who he's telling the story to. I wasn't clear if he was telling it to the priest or not.
I know at the end, you know, the feds come and try and get him to spill the beans, but I don't know. I think it is vague who he's speaking to.
Yeah, because in the scenes where he's sitting there, he's just facing the camera. They never show who's on the other side.
So it might just be a fill-in for Scorsese, you know, telling his story to his audience.
It could be. The funny thing I thought about Frank, you know, we talk about his decision-making. I found him to be a very weak character, and I don't mean poorly written. Last time we talked about Brad Pitt's character and how here was a guy who may or may not have killed his wife, probably did, but may or may not have, but he's just trying to make the best of his life after that. What you have here is a guy who feels like he's just sort of blown by the wind. to me.
So I wouldn't say weak character, but I get what you mean, and I think maybe a better word is passive character or a reactive character. So he's not going out there and taking what he wants. Things are coming his way, and even at the beginning of the film, he crosses paths with Buffalino just by chance because he's at a gas station and Buffalino's there. And it just shows you, like, he was already an older man. I'm not sure how old he was at this point when they crossed paths, and then years later he gets into a life of crime. So yeah, I would say he's a reactive character, and not the smartest. He's definitely like a right hand man.
Yeah, and that was one of the things I found so fascinating about this film. It's called The Irishman. It's about him, but so much of the film, he's not driving the action. In fact, when he does try to drive the action, he gets his wrist slapped. You know, when he goes to bomb the laundromat.
Right.
You can see, you know, for a De Niro character, I'm like, okay, here's the moment.
And he almost gets himself killed.
He almost gets himself killed. You know, here's the moment where De Niro starts to own his role, right? He's going to step into the Godfather role, if you will. You know, it's going to start coming. And as soon as it happens, he's like, I'm sorry.
He gets checked.
He gets checked and he goes right back in line. And I think in so many ways, his character is, like, again, I feel like blown by the wind. You said reactive.
Yeah, like he's the chisel and the gangsters around him are like the artist, you know, hitting that piece of slate.
Yeah, yeah. Even his choice to defend or to kill Hoffa, you know, you can tell he doesn't want to. He just does it and moves on because he's a jobber.
He has no say in the matter.
He has no say.
No sense of agency.
He has no voice. Right. Maybe that's you talk about him at the end of his life. There's his voice. This is what happened. But even that's muted because he doesn't tell certain people.
Right, but it's not even so much that it's muted, it's that he has a strong desire to be heard. This film's, again, I keep repeating this, but it's all about legacy, right? And it's like, you look at your life and you try and make sense of it, and someone who's just had a very reactive role in their own life, they've like messed up their relationships to their family, that's a lot of weight to bear, and you have to make sense of it, and you have to tell yourself lies, and you have to glamorize it. And we see firsthand, his life was not glamorous. He wasn't, like, a great person. He wasn't a smart person or a general. He was a foot soldier.
Yeah.
And if you look at the very last line of the film, as he's, like, sharing his dialogue with you, it's like, what does he say to the audience? He's like, don't close the door. Like, keep the door open. Because he feels like he's not done yet. He has more to say. He has it's not his time to go because he hasn't achieved enough. He hasn't lived enough.
Well, and he talks about finality a couple of times. He said, I would get cremated, but I can't because it feels so final. At least if you're in a box in a building, you know, if you're in a box in a building, it doesn't feel like the real end.
He can't come to terms with it.
He can't come to terms with it.
And again, that's like, you know, how many artists have we seen, how many athletes who it's time for them to step out of the ring or get off the court and they just stay a year or two too long and it's brutal. And that's exactly what happens to Frank. We see him in prison with all these guys who are living the high life and now, you know, they can't even like eat a piece of bread because their teeth are too feeble and they're like sitting around hunched over some terrible wine.
And you see, you bear the weight of his story in so many ways. And even when he tries to talk to his daughters and they won't even speak to him.
It's heartbreaking.
To me, the last 20 minutes is really, like you said, the last half hour, everything comes together. The last half hour is what really makes the film, I think, great, is because the last half hour is where, not where you see an old man, you don't want to see an old man bearing the weight, but it sort of gives greater weight to the story you just saw.
Yeah, and if you think about it, he's a terrible human being. Yeah. Right? He's not someone we would ever want to know, but we fully empathize with him, and we're looking at his sad life, and we want it to end well despite all the terrible things he did. It's just a testament to the performance and Scorsese's writing and filmmaking.
Yeah, absolutely. With that being said, I wanted to talk a little. I wanted to ask you about the question of silence in the film, and not Scorsese's previous film, Silence.
Oh, I hope not.
yeah, that's not fun. That movie's not fun. I just found that there was a role about keeping quiet in this one that comes up in different ways. You know, for example, at the end of his life, he still can't tell his story. And at the same time, Anna Paquin, his daughter, Anna Paquin, her name escapes me, she won't speak. A big controversy has been made over the fact that she's only got four words of dialogue. Scorsese said she didn't need any dialogue because everything's communicated with her face. Boy, he's just making everybody happy right now with his comments.
I will say with the Anna Paquin situation, if he just cast the lesser-known actress, it wouldn't be an issue, right?
Right.
You know, I don't think he wrote that role specifically for her. It just adds more depth and texture to the film, having someone of her stature in that role. But it's really about the detachment she has from her father. I don't think you really need to have a... It would go against what the film's trying to say if they had any sort of meaningful relationship.
Yeah, but I mean, or if she had some great scene, I guess, where she told him off and started screaming. I think so much of this is the part of it that I struggle with, because on the one hand, I totally see the argument, because right now, this is not a film that's going to pass the Bechdel test.
I don't think many Scorsese movies would.
No, they're not. But so I understand the argument for having strong women within the film. I found Paquin's character to be a different type of voice within the film, and I do agree with his point that much of her acting is with her face, because in every scene that she's in, like I felt that it was almost imposed silence on the family. His relationship with his family is so different in some ways than I've seen in so many other mob films, because there isn't any great speech with the dad saying, "I'm doing this for you," that I remember. You know, it's just sort of like, keep your mouth shut. And he doesn't say even that. He just goes and does his thing, and they're expected to keep quiet, I would sort of say. It's almost like in The Godfather, where, you know, Pacino goes into the room and they close the door, and you know, his wife is out there, and you just, that's the final shot where it's sort of like, just stay out. It's almost like it's a separation for him.
Yeah, I mean, there's a detachment between him and his family. So in many films, he would be resorting to a life of crime so his family could live life fast and easy. And this, it's like you don't really know if that's the reason he's doing things. You know, is it giving him a sense of meaning? Does he like, you know, feeling important? Does he like feeling part of, you know, the what's going on with Hoffa and that whole movement, which was like on the cover of every paper? Was he doing it for that? Was he doing it for the thrill, the rush, or was he doing it for his family? Regardless, he doesn't know his family. He doesn't spend time with them. And seeing the film through his eyes, we don't know his family either. So there's that gap. And I think by having more intimate moments together, that would kind of disrupt that feeling of, you know, that detachment he has from them.
And maybe the word is purpose. I'm just thinking of this now. Like, it's interesting you say that, because I didn't get a sense of what his general overall purpose is. A lot of times you hear those things. I'm doing this so my family can have a better life, or I'm doing this. You can see he's trying to climb up the ladder of power. In the case of Frank, it almost feels like almost Darwinian survival. It's just sort of like, you're next. You like what I'm doing? Oh, thank you. Okay, then I'll go with you now because you're the next one up.
Well, there is that sense of honor he has from receiving the ring.
That is true.
That's a big moment. And towards the end, he still has that ring, which just kind of lends more credence to the notion that this was more for his mafia family than the family he has back at home.
Yeah, and Buffalino is essentially his parental figure in many ways within the film. There's no indication of any previous family. They don't talk about his parents at all. Buffalino just sort of steps into that role, which is interesting because I kept wondering to myself, I'm like, is Pesci older than De Niro? Like, are they the same age? Anyway.
Even young De Niro looked like old De Niro.
It's true. But, you know, one of the aspects, you know, going back to the idea of silence, that I thought was particularly fascinating was the end of the film, and he still struggles to get the words out. You know, here we've sat there for 3 hours at this point hearing him tell us the story. But then when the feds come and they say to him, it's over, everyone's dead, just tell us what happened.
I think that's him still holding on to the last vestiges of his old life, right? And that code of, we did this, we did it for a reason, we were great, we had our moment. And, you know, by giving up the story now, it kind of takes the air out of that notion he has of himself.
But what about with his kids? Like, he meets with his daughters. I thought this was, like, I was sitting there, and it was such a powerful moment, and his other daughter is sitting there, because Anna Paquin won't speak to him, because that's not what she does. but he's sitting there with his other daughter, and she says, you know, he says, I'm really sorry. For what, Dad? For everything. Again, for what, Dad? just for everything or something. He can't even, I don't even know if he knows what he's apologizing for other than the fact that there's no relationship there. Like, he doesn't seem to take any ownership for any actions he's done.
Yeah.
He has not put any on himself, and yet he feels this incredible shame. But I don't know if he knows what he's feeling the shame for.
And a sense of entitlement to pick things up where they left off. Mm-hmm. Right? You can't do that. Like, blood is thicker than water, but you still have to put in the time and nurture these relationships. And he just neglected that for years. And now when there's nothing left for him, the criminal life is gone and he has his family. Like, he's burned those bridges. It's just no road back to the life he wants.
But even that, I don't even know if he knows where the bridges are. Because she's asking him, I think she'd be willing in that scene to rebuild those bridges. I think she would if he would take some ownership. But he just apologizes for quote unquote everything.
Right.
And well, what is everything, Dad? Are you sorry that you treated us badly? Are you sorry that you killed people? Are you sorry that you were brutal to our, well, that you beat up the grocer? Like, he has no specifics. He just feels sad, and maybe he wouldn't if their relationship somehow survived. I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But I think he's a fascinating character. I think there's a lot of, like, this is a compelling character drama that allows itself to sort of play by its own rules in terms of expectations.
Yeah, every aspect of the film, from plot wise, thematically, through the lines of dialogue to the blocking for a scene is just so considered. You really get the sense that there's like a master craftsman behind the scenes just making sure everything is just so they can get the story in their mind and their heart across on screen.
It is amazing to see the cast they put together. Like, it is just, I mean, that's incredible. It's nice to see Joe Pesci on screen again.
Yeah, it's a shame he hasn't done more in the last few years. I mean, he's given us enough. So if he wants to go off on a retirement, that's fine. But just seeing him back, my heart was kind of mourned all the roles he passed up in the last decade.
I may be wrong on this, but I heard that it took them 6 months to convince him.
I buy that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love the cast. I mean, I grew up on those Scorsese movies, the gangster flicks and all the other ones. And I love seeing these guys on screen. And this film isn't that whiz-bang gangster movie like Casinos and Goodfellas or even Mean Streets. But there is one scene I would put up there as like a Scorsese all-timer that's just fire. And that's when Frank and I forget the man's name, the guy who shows up in the shorts for the business meeting.
Oh, yeah. Square off. Pro, something. Tony Pro.
Yeah,
Tony
Pro. And that's as fun as anything you'll see in any Scorsese movie.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great moment. Tony. And again, you know, when they introduce Tony Pro, they introduce him in such a way that I kind of thought he was a character that's just going to sort of disappear. But he's essential to the way they want to unfold.
Yeah, he's a thorn in their side. That's for sure.
He shows up 15 minutes late.
Yeah, look forward to that if you haven't seen the movie.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this one's probably fairly obvious, but we should screen it or skip it. The Irishman, screen it or skip it.
The only question is, how many times are you going to screen it?
Ooh, that's a bold statement.
I say minimum two.
Where would you screen it?
Definitely a theater, if it's available.
You think go to a theater instead of waiting?
Yeah, I think one time each is fair.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't see it more than once in a theater. I think it's a definite screen it. Like, I think the quality of the film is so good. I don't think it's going to resonate with a certain age bracket. I just don't think they're going to have the patience for it, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, it's not the flashy gangster flick people may be expecting, but it's, you know, it's as insightful and entertaining as anything he's put out.
Yeah, I agree fully. I think it's a great film. I would be very happy to say you could see it in a theater. I'm also okay with you seeing it on Netflix, but try and sit through it all at once before you start doing it in 20-minute blockages.
You gotta see it in one sitting.
You know, again, going back to that, I wonder how it would change if they had done that. Like, if you could have made this into a four-episode, 40 or 50-minute episodes and made it into a miniseries, thrown it on HBO, but they wanted it to be a cinematic experience.
Yeah, I mean, to hit you the hardest, it just has to wash over you, right? And you can't do that in four chunks. And, it's interesting to bring that up because Netflix is really changing how we watch things, because television for generations was just written leading up to a commercial break, picking up and then building to another climax before a commercial break. Then we got to the point where there's just a climax at the end of the show to kind of draw you into the next one. Now that they know we're watching things in chunks, they don't have that dramatic tension at the end of everything. Things just kind of click off and pick up. So it'd be interesting to see how that film would flow in a different format.
And you know what? Going back to our earlier conversation, I would just say this too. I would also suspect that Scorsese, and this is my more sinister aspect to it, knows which side the bread is buttered. And if he wants older Oscar voters to move past the fact that it's a Netflix jam, then what do? You start talking about classic cinema. Talk about the different ways that films were made. That would be my what's the word, conspiratorial opinion on the conversation.
He's definitely bringing them to his side of the partisan divide.
Yeah, it feels that way to me. That's what it feels like.
Don't worry, guys.
No
coincidence this all comes out at the same time as his movie, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. He knows what he's doing. Anyway.
Breaking news. Martin Scorsese knows what he's doing.
Oh, Vic, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
It was a blast.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. For you at home, a reminder that you can find us wherever podcasts are available, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, Podomatic, and you can find us via Stitcher on your Alexa device. And if you go to the podcast page at screenfish.net, you can download Fishing for More, small group questions that you can ask if you decide to see the film with the people that you see it with as well. We will be back next week with Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. I think we actually said last week it was this week, but I think it was a bit of a scheduling snafu. But we will be back next week to talk about Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, the new Tom Hanks semi-quote biopic on Mr. Rogers. But yeah, so thanks again. Really appreciate it, Vic. It's a lot of fun. And for you at home, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish.